holy man, markets can work in places where they hadn't been used before, but happen to be where all the pollution is.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. If you're an occasional visitor to a major city in a developing world, you might have woken up one morning, looked out the window, and been surprised, and not in a good way, by the haze of pollution that fills the air. If, of course, you live in these cities, you will know that pollution from particulate matter is a lifelong problem and occasionally a life-threatening problem as well. What policies work best to deal with this? An experiment in Gujarat suggests that using pollution markets rather than regulation is not a policy that is only useful for high-income countries. Michael Greenstone of the University of Chicago was one of the researchers and one of the authors of a paper that has analyzed the results. Michael, welcome back to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Michael, how bad is the air pollution in India, in Gujarat?
I was just in India in December. And actually, it's the northern belt where it's the worst, although it's by no means okay in Gujarat. But it's just in Delhi, and it was dystopian.
Yeah.
You couldn't see the sun in the middle of the day. People were just carrying on, as people do, in all kinds of adverse circumstances. But it is, in some sense, probably what London was in the 1950s and the 1960s.
Yes.
What my hometown of Chicago was in the 60s and 70s. But it is unacceptable.
Dozens of people have been detained by police in India as hundreds took to the streets of New Delhi to protest against toxic air. A thick layer of smog is hanging over the Indian capital, pushing up air pollution to dangerous levels and worsening a public health crisis.
As winter sets, queues get longer in hospitals. A primary reason, the deadly air that blankets the national capital and its surroundings. Dr. Alok Ranjan sees hundreds of patients every day, and most relate to breathing problems.
There is a toxic brew in much of the air over India, sparked by everything from farmers burning their fields to industrial pollution.
As you say, people carry on in these adverse circumstances, but what is the cost to them of doing that?
I've done a lot of research over the last couple of decades on what the consequences are of exposure, long-run exposure, not one day exposure, high levels of particulate air pollution. Particulates, I think, are the greatest public health threat on the planet. So the average person on the planet is losing more years of life expectancy to particulates than to HIV, than to cigarettes, than to alcohol, to drugs, anything. The average person is about 2 years, but that average obscures a lot. In London and in Chicago and places like that, it's very low. It's a couple months. In places like India, it's 3.5 years on average, and it can be more in places like Delhi. And so just imagine, like, if people from outer space came down and started taking a couple of years of life expectancy off of people's lives, there'd be enormous outrage.
That would.
But particulates, it happens slow. We're doing it to ourselves. There's all kinds of economic trade-offs underneath it, and it becomes really complicated, and in too many settings, there's kind of an acceptance.
But this is a very visible problem, literally a visible problem. What's the government trying to do about this? What has it been doing about this, and why is that not working?
You could be asking about anywhere in the world, but I think you're asking about India.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this phrase in the United States legislation that underlines the Clean Air Act, which is to protect the public health. And it's kind of innocuous and boring phrase, but it's super important because it basically says right from the start that clean air has benefits for humans. And it doesn't use this language, but those benefits need to be traded off against what the costs are. And that phrase is missing in the Indian legislation. And I think that is maybe not the only reason, but it's a big part of the reason that it's treated kind of like as a technical engineering problem. And One that just has a bunch of costs. It's annoying and hard to measure all the time. You got to get the monitoring equipment on the factories that are doing the pollution. The factories have to pay more to build whatever widget that they're building because of the pollution abatement equipment that is required. There's not this built into the system, this counterbalancing. Well, we're doing all that and it's expensive. Yeah, that's true, but we're getting some big benefits out of it to contrast. And so that's missing. And the consequence is it does get treated as this technical annoying problem. And there's not a laser focus on reducing air pollution.
And the technique that's used is basically regulation, telling people you shouldn't be polluting. Yes. Here is a standard.
A regulation we're gonna, hold you to. From the 1970s and the 1980s right. In today's rich countries. It's very much, Tim, you better shape up. You better install this equipment. Do as I say. The goal becomes, did you install the pollution abatement equipment, not what's coming out of your stack? And so it's very heavy-handed. And then in addition, the regulator has very, very clunky ways to make Tim behave or comply. And effectively, there's a bunch of letters they can write that are kind of wagging their finger. You should be a better boy. You should do better. You should pollute less, et cetera, all the way up to we'll close you down. And we'll close you down in an emerging economy where the need for economic growth is vital and urgent and people's livelihoods depend on it in much sharper ways than they depend on it in developed countries. The regulator doesn't want to apply that penalty, and the plant doesn't really like this giant sledgehammer over their head. So you had this kind of very clunky system, and the result is widespread noncompliance with the law.
Now, if the pollution police aren't working, then economists like yourself all over the world are of the opinion that markets might work better at getting companies not to pollute. Why?
We have terrific evidence from, I would say, the rich countries in the world. Probably the canonical example was the U.S. SO2 market in the 1990s set up under George H.W. Bush. And that worked remarkably, bringing down acid rain in the eastern United States by tremendous amounts. And the projections for costs of what it would cost to do that proved to be way overstated to compare to what the costs actually were. And the idea was, rather than tell Tim to ship up and shape out, set a goal that was shared among all the polluters and say, we don't really care what you do to get pollution down, just collectively you have to do it. And if it's very expensive for Tim, then Tim can pay Michael to reduce his pollution. And we don't care because it's a total pollution and that's what people breathe. And that worked just fabulously. And there's been many other markets in the United States. The UK has a CO2 market. The EU has a big CO2 market. They've all worked very, very well. Now, I have to say, I've thought a lot about this. There's a resistance to markets. Uh-huh. And I think it's because we all deep down have some engineering instinct. Right, we want to see the machine that's going to catch the particles coming out of the stack. We want to see it being strapped onto the stack and operating. And like, if it's there, we're going to feel really confident. And the thing with markets is you give up on that control and you say, you know, you don't have to do that. You're a smart guy. You run a business. You have some other way to do that. And all we're going to do is measure what comes out. It's a little bit like with my kids, I could sit with them and go line through line on the homework. And from 7:30 to 8 o'clock, we'll do math. And 8 to 8:30, we'll do history, whatever it is. Or I could just say, your homework has to be done at the end of the night. I don't really care how it gets done. And I think we have this engineering instinct as humans that want the former more than the latter. What's interesting, I think, is these markets have worked really well in rich countries, and that's wonderful and beautiful and great. But like the pollution is all in the developing countries these days. The non-OECD countries are going to account for 82% of greenhouse gases through the remainder of the century. Almost all the particulates pollution is in today's emerging economies of the global south. And yet, this super awesome tool called markets had not been applied in them. It was only being applied in our relatively pristine places.
Hi there, Oliver Hanney here, managing editor of VoxDev and the host of our new podcast, Ideas in Development. Over February and March, Dina Musa and I are hosting a series of conversations about the economics of AI. We've talked to Rose Matiso, Raghuram Rajan, Anton Koronek, Josh Lerner, and other leading thinkers and researchers across 10 episodes. To listen to this series on AI, go to the separate Ideas in Development podcast feed by searching Ideas in Development wherever you get your podcasts.
So your experiment took place in Gujarat, as we said. Why doesn't Gujarat and places like Gujarat have pollution markets?
When my colleagues, Rohini Pandey, Nick Ryan, and Anant Sudarshan, and I began this project, we were perplexed by that too. And we started peddling this idea. You guys should try markets. It's not that they hadn't heard of markets. There was just a sense like, well, that's not for us, or that's not going to work here. I don't know how that set in, but it set in. And so in some sense, this experiment, which we ran, the details of which I could talk about much longer than any podcast listener could ever be interested in, you could think of it as really a test of proof of concept. Can these markets work in the global South? And the too long didn't read version is we ran an experiment in the state of Gujarat with the Gujarat Pollution Control Board, and it crushed in ways that we didn't even expect. It brought plants were widespread non-compliance with the law. That is, they were exceeding the amount of pollution that they should have been emitting. That became basically perfect compliance with the law in the market. This is with a randomized control trial. So it's like that gold standard of evidence. Pollution went down by 20 to 25%. And the plants were doing the polluting. What markets are supposed to offer them is to make it cheaper for them to comply with the law. Their costs went down by about 12%. It was a win-win-win. And like, I hesitate to say this because it sounds like P.T. Barnum cartoon, but we did a cost-benefit analysis, and like, economists get super excited when the benefits are like 1.3 times the costs. Like, oh, victory. Here, the benefits are like 200 times the cost. And it's because it comes back to the beginning of our conversation. Air pollution is so terrible for people. And so we found a way to reduce it and to reduce industry costs. And so then, you know, the benefits were just piling up left and right.
Our audience is a very patient audience when the topic's interesting, and this one is. Can you tell me a little bit about how this was designed? Because the problem with pollution is you can't randomize who's exposed to it.
Yes. So the way this was designed was the regulator basically found 300 firms, plants in the city of Surat, where that were all basically burning coal on site. And most of them, almost all, were in the textile industry. And said, okay, this is how we're going to test it. And let me just say, like, a government official, a regulator agreeing to a real experiment is quite remarkable. And the Gujarat Control Board is just astonishing. Anyway, we took the 300 random number generator, 150 went into the market, 150 continued to be regulated the status quo way. And then we tracked them over 5 years and roughly about 10 compliance periods.
5 years, because again, these experiments, you cannot get results in 6 months, 9 months.
There were results quickly. I think we wanted to see if it was durable or if it was beginning and fresh and new. That's why the results were happening. But the results really proved to be, with a COVID interruption in the middle, proved to be quite durable. And look, I like numbers. They give me comfort. They make me feel like I understand the world better. There's also qualitative things. The plants in the control group, who were continuing to be regulated in the kind of clunky way, were calling the regulator and asking to be moved into the market. They didn't like they didn't like that they continued to face a clunky form of regulation. So it was, as I said, the compliance, the pollution, the abatement costs, all off the charts. But in some sense, to focus on them, I think, is to miss the big picture. The big picture was, whoa, markets can work in a setting that we didn't think that they would work.
And is this market working in the same way as pollution markets work in high-income countries where you allocate permits and then those permits are traded? You had successful market for trading.
Yeah. People were trading. There's 80% free allocation and then 20% auctioning off. And people's starting position of permits was very different than their ending position. And you had trades all over the place.
and ensuring that people are compliant, because even though you have a market, you cannot then just chuck away compliance, can you?
No.
They still had to go on.
There's no market without monitoring.
Yeah.
So you have to know how much everyone polluted. And so a lot of effort was put into that. There is an interesting story. In the very first compliance period, the period came to a close. And the key way that these markets work is for every unit of pollution that you emitted during that period, you have to hold a permit for that. That is, you're buying the right to pollute. And two relatively big firms didn't have enough permits. And of course, they were pretty well connected. And they're basically saying to the regulator, I dare you. And the regulator called me and he said, wait a minute. What am I supposed to do? These guys don't have the right number of permits. Uh-huh. And we'd written with the regulator very detailed rules like, hey, if you don't have enough permits, you're going to have to pay, I don't remember, like 10 times the permit prices. So it's meant to make it so large, no one would want to be in that situation. And I said, well, you know, we've been working on this together for 5 years. I think we should burn the whole thing down right now if you don't apply the penalties that were specified in the rule book, because no one will ever hold the right number of permits again once they see you're not going to enforce it.
Sure.
And he goes, oh, I think I'm going to have to call some people to make sure that that's okay. And much to his credit and the state of Gujarat's credit and the Gujarat Pollution Control Board, he came back and said, okay, that's what we're going to do. He went right down the rule book that we'd written. Those plants were fined the appropriate amount. And forevermore, everyone held the right number of permits. There's a great man theory of history. He was a great man.
So we're saying both that using the market in Gujarat was successful at cutting the pollution, but also that it was more efficient as a method to cut pollution than command and control could be.
Yeah.
And that the cost benefit, tell me that cost benefit again, because it's a remarkable figure.
My view is that the right thing is maybe 200 to 1. Mm-hmm. Some of my co-authors think, oh, maybe it's 100 to 1. I don't know. It doesn't matter. It's like way, way more than the cost. You know, I should just add one thing to give you, I should have done this, the state of regulation and the status quo.
Yeah.
So the regulator just didn't have much visibility into what plants were doing. He was amazing at enforcing a rule. You couldn't operate unless you show me a receipt and I can come and see that you have purchased very expensive pollution abatement equipment. And what was true all over the place was, yes, he could enforce that you had to buy the pollution abatement equipment. He could not enforce that it would be run. And so you saw all these plants with this expensive equipment sitting there, effectively just not plugged in.
Yeah.
And a big piece of this is just getting the monitoring right. And so we had this, underneath it was this continuous emissions monitoring. So you could see second by second what was coming out of the stack.
What's the playbook for policymakers that are implementing this? Because there is a long history of things working well in one place and not in another.
Yeah. So we always go, that is so great. You're interested in doing this. Awesome. Hey, could you show us your data? And that's where the wonky side comes out. And so the first step is to just get data on who their big polluters are. Do they have any visibility into high frequency pollution? Everyone says, oh, yes, we do. And then you're like, oh, well, could you share the continuous emissions monitor data? And oftentimes that begins a process of trying to improve the way that's being collected. So I don't know if that's what you were asking, but yes, the wonkiness has to be part of it.
It is exactly what I was asking. You got this amazing result. And in a perfect world, I would imagine there would be a queue outside your door of policymakers from different states, different countries around the world that share this problem, saying, how do we do this? So first of all, is it carrying on in Gujarat? And secondly, is this being used elsewhere?
Yeah. So they were so excited by in Gujarat that the first thing they did was they took all the control plants and they dumped them into the market in Surat. And so that market doubled. Mm-hmm. Then they started a second market in Ahmedabad. And we're now, the other day or a few months ago, I was back there and the head of the pollution control board said, oh, you know, I've really always been bothered by water pollution. Do you think we could start a market for water pollution? And I said, yes, we're in. Sounds great.
Let's do it. Yeah.
And, you know, what I skipped over was my colleagues and I had this idea and we marched around from state to state in India trying to make it happen for quite a while. And Gujarat was the only place that would work with us in the end. And so it was kind of lonely and a lot of failure. He felt a little bit like a traveling salesman. That's totally flipped now that these results are out there and that people see that it has worked so well in Gujarat. And now I'm not selling NVIDIA GPU chips. I don't want to overstate the queue, but there really is something of a queue now. There's more demand from regulators in India and outside India than honestly we have the resources to handle. That's why I started with some colleagues something called the Emissions Market Accelerator.
Uh-huh.
And its idea is academics are awesome. Everyone loves a good academic. They want to have them, pull them out of the drawer once in a while and pet them and say, look, here's an academic. But academics are not the right people to get things done in the world, oftentimes. And so this is really a independent scale-up organization that is staffed with different kinds of people. And we are on track to launch a statewide sulfur dioxide market that wouldn't be textile plants, it would include power plants, like big hulking power plants, in the state of Maharashtra in the next couple months, where we just were in Rajasthan, where we're had a public event announcing their plans to start a market there. There's advanced conversations with several other states in India and Pakistan, which I think kind of has as a principle that we don't really want to do things that India does. I want to phrase it correctly, but there's advanced efforts there to start a market to address some of the pollution problems in Pakistan as well. And there's conversations in Brazil. That's why I think the most important thing is not that pollution went down by 20 or 25% and that compliance went up and that abatement costs went down. The TLDR version is, holy man, markets can work in places where they hadn't been used before, but happen to be where all the pollution is.
Michael, thank you very much for talking about it.
Thank you, Tim. What a great pleasure.
The paper's called Can Pollution Markets Work in Developing Countries? Experimental Evidence from India. Authors Michael Greenstone, Rohini Pandey, Nicholas Ryan, and Anant Sudarshan. It is Becker Friedman Institute Working Paper 2025, number 53. This has been a VoxDev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. You know what I'm going to say by now. Subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. You will find articles about all the topics we feature at voxdev.org, as well as all our podcasts from the past. And if you are subscribing, remember as well to leave us a review, a good one. VoxDev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hani and Iman Siddiq at VoxDev.